What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The UN Security Council has condemned North Korea's latest ballistic missile launch as a grave violation of previous council resolutions and threatened further significant measures. Ukraine's ambassador, Volodymyr Yelchenko, was this month's council president.
These launches are in grave violation of the DPRK's international obligations under the UN Security Council Resolutions 1718, 1874, 2087, 2094, 2270 and 2321. The members of the Council deplore all the Democratic People's Republic of Korea ballistic missiles activities, including these launches, noting that such activities contribute to the DPRK's development of nuclear weapons delivery systems and increased tension.
At a White House news conference, President Donald Trump called North Korea and its nuclear missile programs a big problem and vowed to deal with it strongly. Tufts University Korea analyst Sung-Yoon Lee says he doesn't believe the latest UN condemnation will affect the North's behavior.
It is not an enforceable measure. It is more a symbolic condemnation, which has no impact on North Korean behavior.
South Korea's Yonhap News Agency says the missile was a new type with a range of more than 2,000 kilometers, describing it as an upgraded extended-range version of a submarine launch rocket. White House National Security Advisor retired General Michael Flynn has resigned over his contacts with Russian officials before President Trump took office. Flynn acknowledged providing incomplete information about his discussions with the Russian ambassador to the U.S. to Vice President Mike Pence. At issue was whether the matter of sanctions on Russia over its annexation of Crimea were discussed. Retired General Keith Kellogg has been named as his acting replacement. This is VOA News. President Trump said the U.S. will likely only make minor changes to the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, in negotiations with Canada.
Our relationship with Canada is outstanding, and we're going to work together to make it even better. And as far as the southern border is concerned, we're going to get that worked out. We're going to make it fair, but we are going to make it so that everybody is happy.
Mr. Trump spoke alongside Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who made his first visit to the White House since Mr. Trump's inauguration January 20th. Three-quarters of Canadian exports go to its southern neighbor. Mr. Trudeau said Canada and the U.S. have a close relationship despite their differences.
The last thing Canadians expect is for me to come down and lecture another country on how they choose to govern themselves. My role, our responsibility, is to continue to govern in such a way that reflects Canadians' approach and be a positive example in the world.
He said while the countries at times differ in approaches, it's always done so firmly and respectfully. In Pakistan, an explosion near the Punjab Provincial Assembly building in Lahore killed at least 13 people, including five policemen, and wounded dozens of others Monday. Authorities say the blast was caused by a suicide bomber. A breakaway faction of the Pakistan Taliban, Jamaat-ul-Ahrar, claimed responsibility. At least 13 people were killed in central Mali in inter-ethnic clashes between Fulanis and Bambaras. Witnesses put the death toll higher. The clashes were triggered by the murder of a Bambara farmer on Saturday, followed by retribution killings on a Fulani village. Three members of Cameroon's English-speaking opposition have pleaded not guilty to terrorism charges at a military court. They were arrested last month, charged with terrorism, secession, revolution, insurrection, and inciting civil war. Each charge is punishable by death. Since October, people in the country's two western English-speaking regions have joined protests against what they say is their marginalization at the hands of the French-speaking majority. Seven Hong Kong policemen have been found guilty of assaulting a pro-independence protester in 2014. They face a maximum 3 years in prison, but they were not convicted of the more serious charge of grievous bodily harm with intent. Their attack was on protester Ken Sang, who met with reporters after the verdict.
I had already been assaulted and was later assaulted yet again in the police station.
Sang himself was found guilty last year of assaulting officers and resisting arrest. The U.S. Monday blacklisted Venezuela's Vice President Tariq El Asami for alleged drug trafficking. An associate and 13 other companies were also sanctioned. El Asami is said to have facilitated shipments of narcotics from Venezuela. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A former African Union official is calling on parties in South Sudan's conflict to once again choose peace over violence.
It is up to the people of South Sudan in their reconciliation to embrace all those other rebels or groups that are not in the country or persons who are not in the country, that they can then produce lasting peace.
Erastus Mwecha is the immediate past deputy chair of the African Union Commission. An influential South Sudanese says the reality of his country requires more than condemnation. The United Nations mission in the Central African Republic has fired on FPRC rebels, and Somalia's new president is urged to come up with a new strategy to deal with Al-Shabaab.
President Farmajo, during the campaigns, has signaled his intent to actually use a variety of tools to basically diminish Al-Shabaab in Somalia.
Omar Mohamed Abu Ayan is a former Al-Shabaab fighter and a Malawian vintner, finds success that boosts his community. The stories, plus our Black History Month facts and contests, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The immediate past deputy chair of the African Union Commission says African leaders have always supported belonging to the International Criminal Court because they believe it can be an instrument to addressing some of the shortcomings that may be at national levels or continental levels. But Erastus Mwecha, who served two consecutive terms, 8 years, says the ICC needs to listen more to what Africa is saying. In part two of my exclusive interview, Mr. Mwecha also called some parties in South Sudan's conflict to once again choose peace over violence. He says the people of South Sudan, in their efforts at reconciliation, must embrace all South Sudanese.
First of all, you know that the IGAD-led peace process has produced a comprehensive peace agreement that is being implemented. I must say that not all of them moving as fast as we would have liked to, but this is the nature of conflict. Once a country has gone through this kind of trauma, it takes time for the country to regain the rhythm that was there before such a conflict. Now, as for the former vice president, of course the peace agreement is being implemented with his absence, and it is up to the people of South Sudan in their reconciliation to embrace all those other rebels or groups that are not in the country or persons who are not in the country, that they can then produce lasting peace. It is not for us to dictate who comes to the table. It is for the people of South Sudan, for them to reach agreement. What we have insisted on in the past is that there must be commitment, there must be respect to the peace agreement, and the people of South Sudan must then choose peace and move forward to address issues of where there were weaknesses that produced peace.
Coming into the just-concluded African Union Summit in Addis Ababa, one would have thought that the continent was on the way out of the ICC, the International Criminal Court. But now it appears the African Union is backing away or softening its position on the ICC. What is the situation?
African Union has always said that they supported and belonged to the ICC because they believed it's a very good instrument for addressing shortcomings that may be at national level or continental level, because as we speak, we don't have a mechanism at the continental level that people can resort to in cases of crimes against humanity. It is also the belief and the determination of African countries that this could be solved by listening to each other. Unfortunately, I think the ICC has a lot to do in this area, so that it can change the stance and listen to what the African leaders are saying. And African leaders are not asking for anything extraordinary that is not provided under the international law. I don't know what you call softening, because the pronouncements that you may have had coming from the African Union are not unique from what has been in the past. Any strategy that is developed at national level cannot be seen to be all embracing the role of the member states. It must be subject to the national law. Member states must take their own decision, even when there is a general agreement on a strategy, like in the case of ISIS.
The new president of the United States, Donald Trump, has imposed a travel ban, and three African countries are affected: Sudan, Somalia, and Libya. Is there a particular view from the African Union perspective when you were there?
The African Union has issued a statement which, of course, called for lifting of those sanctions because, in our view, and this has been exonerated by the courts in the United States, they were discriminatory and they were done in haste and have caused a lot of confusion around the world. We hope that as the courts continue to address this matter, we will find an amicable way of doing things because the United States of all countries is negating even on some of its own values by banning even people that are refugees running out of conflict, an unprecedented situation that has not occurred around the world, even in the worst of the times. And that's why we see even in the United States, this matter is being challenged in court.
Personally, you serve your continent. Then what are you going to do hereafter? What are your plans?
Well, first of all, I think I'll have an opportunity to reflect and do some of my memoirs. I've been looking forward to an opportunity to do that. I will continue to have my passion on integration. I'll continue to contribute at the national and also at family level. And so I feel that I have now an opportunity to do some of those things that I am to contribute personally to in a different context.
Mr. Mwencha, I personally want to say also thank you for making yourself accessible in your very, very important position as the Deputy Chair of the African Union. And we wish you luck wherever you go.
Thank you very much. I wish you the same. And for me, it has been a pleasure to work with you and many of your colleagues at VOA. And I wish you the best in the years ahead.
Erastus Mwecha is the media pastor, deputy chair of the African Union Commission. He was speaking with me from New Delhi, India. The UN Security Council has condemned continuing fighting in South Sudan. It urges the transitional government of national unity to take measures to ensure that perpetrators are held accountable for human rights violations that include killing civilians, ethnic violence, and the looting of livestock and property. One influential South Sudanese political figure says his country needs more than carefully worded condemnations to end the violence in parts of the country. Ayem Bior has more from Washington.
Pagana Amum, co-founder of South Sudan Reborn and former Secretary General of the SPLM, who was in Washington, D.C. for meetings, says he welcomes UN condemnations of human rights violations, saying it shows the Security Council remains focused on South Sudan's ongoing conflict. But he says statements alone will not ease rising tensions or prevent further atrocities from happening in his native country.
The reality of the country now in the country requires more than just condemnation. I'm afraid the Security Council of United Nations is losing credibility with the people of South Sudan as it is only reiterating the same condemnation to the atrocities that are being committed by the regime in Juba.
On December 16th last year, the Security Council unanimously approved a resolution extending the UNMISS mandate for another year. The resolution raised the troop contribution ceiling to 17,000, which included room for an additional 4,000 peacekeepers to be sent to South Sudan as a regional protection force. It also called for UNMISS to use all necessary means to deter and prevent sexual violence and to monitor and record instances of hate speech. In the resolution, the council expressed deep concern of the possibility of an outright ethnic war. Just 1 week later, a U.S.-led UN Security Council resolution to impose an arms embargo and targeted sanctions on South Sudan failed to receive the 9 required votes to pass. Again, Pagana Amum.
The Security Council has the obligation to protect the people of South Sudan from such a regime, and therefore it calls for an immediate intervention to protect the people of South Sudan and to stabilize South Sudan and prevent South Sudan from collapsing into chaos and disorder. In many occasions, the Security Council has unanimously decided on the situation in South Sudan. And therefore, it is time that they move beyond their repeated condemnations.
Amum worries the Security Council will lose credibility if their statements are not followed up with action.
Kiir cannot be allowed to defy the international community and the region indefinitely and play these games while continuing to spread violence and to throw South Sudan into massive destruction.
The peace agreement offers solutions to bring justice to victims of the conflict, including the establishment of a commission for truth, reconciliation, and healing, and a hybrid court for trying perpetrators of human rights abuses. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa. On the Voice of America, I'm James Bate in Washington, and today is Tuesday, February 14th. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 and a half minutes past the hour. Tensions continue in Cameroon as the strike in the country's English-speaking regions nears the end of its third month. Three strike leaders pleaded not guilty on Monday to charges of terrorism and insurrection before a military tribunal. They are accused of calling for the English-speaking parts of the country to secede. As Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, the three could face the death penalty if convicted.
Nkongo Felix Agbobala, Fontem Afortika Neba, and BBC Mancho are accused of organizing demonstrations in December that turned violent. The government says national flags were burned, and the flag of a supposedly new independent nation was lifted. The government deployed the military, and at least seven people were killed in the unrest. The three men entered the courtroom Monday, joined by more than 100 lawyers working on their defense. Defense counsel Ben Muna says his clients were arrested illegally.
The preliminary objection which we raised had to do with how the case was investigated, which is the proof that the prosecution said they're not ready. They don't have witnesses.
The case has been adjourned until March 23rd. English-speaking lawyers and teachers have been on strike since November. They are protesting what they say is the overwhelming use of French in their sectors. But the strike has drawn other activists who accused the state of marginalizing English speakers living primarily in the southwest and the northwest. Some strikers are calling for a return to federalism, while other leaders want secession. The government says neither are options. Negotiations broke down over the issue early this year. The strikers are also demanding the unconditional release of everyone arrested in connection with the strike. The government says 70 people are detained. Activists say the number is higher. More arrests happened this past weekend during unrest in the northwestern town of Ndop. President Biya issued a statement Friday. He is open to dialogue, but the president said national unity is not up for negotiation and all detainees must face justice. The government has made some changes to address strikers' grievances. President Biya has transferred non-English-speaking judges out of the striking zones and announced plans to recruit 1,000 bilingual teachers.
Les objets,
Here, students in a public school in Yaoundé perform a sketch encouraging people to use both languages. Teachers like Bibian Ayuk say they have received instructions to promote bilingualism.
When they have activities in school, it's carried out in both languages. And we encourage teachers when they go to school to carry out what they call jeu bilingue. That is a 5 minutes talk in your second language while teaching.
English speakers constitute just 20% of the population, but the Constitution says English and French should be equally important. Since the strike began, some official documents can now be found in English. English has also been added to signs for state radio and television and various government ministries. High-ranking government officials have begun giving public remarks in both languages. Despite the changes, the government has drawn a hard line on the strike. In January, authorities banned public gatherings in the two affected regions and cut all internet access. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A former al-Shabaab official is urging the new president of Somalia to come up with new strategy to deal with the militant group. Omar Mohamed Abu Aya, who was a preacher and the right-hand man to Ibrahim Haji Afghan, one of the founders of al-Shabaab, says the new president will have to move away from the strategies used by previous governments if he is to have an impact in the fight against the militant group.
I think President Farmajo, during the campaigns, has signaled his intent to actually use a variety of tools to basically, I think, diminish al-Shabaab strength in Somalia. One, of course, is to rebuild the Somali security forces. And this is, of course, one critical area because the president is known to have very close relationship with the security services. And many people actually think that if there is one man who can fix the Somali security problem, it's actually Farmajo. And the second point is, I think he's also aware that he needs actually to invest in better political systems to undermine al-Shabaab's strength. One, of course, is to strengthen the federal system, but also to I think, in more inclusive politics at regional level. We all know now that al-Shabaab feeds on those inter-clan grievances at the local level. And then another plank of his, I think, strategy is also to embark on some selective engagement with individual al-Shabaab or groups that are disenchanted with al-Shabaab.
And do you think he can be successful in that? Do you think he can sway a larger number of al-Shabaab? Al-Shabaab, they were individuals who were defecting, but overall they did not have any impact on their leadership, on their strength, on their states.
Our sense is that there will, even with the best, I think, engagement process, there will be elements who, for a variety of reasons, will never fully come on board this process of, I think, political settlement because of their hardline ideological position. There will be groups opposed to dialogue with what they call an apostate government. So, you know, let's not get our hopes very high about, you know, the outcome of an engagement. I think if done sincerely and honestly, there will be some weakening of al-Shabaab because elements, you know, who for some reasons want a political settlement may come on board. But I think, you know, this process of dialogue is something that has to be done in tandem, I think, with other broader measures of stabilizing, I think, Somalia. You know, we have to see better investment in the federal project. We have to make more inclusive politics in the regions as well as in Mogadishu. And I think this is a president who, unprecedented, you know, he enjoys cross-clan support. And that, I think, gives him more greater credibility and legitimacy to basically engage with elements of al-Shabaab who may want a political settlement.
Omar Mohamed Abu Ayan is a former al-Shabaab fighter. He spoke with Haroon Maruf of VOA's Somali service. The United Nations mission, known as MINUSCA, fired on fighters from the Popular Front for the Renaissance of Central African Republic over the weekend after they crossed a red line, said officials. MINUSCA spokesman Vladimir Montero tells Ricky Stryer that the former Seleka rebels seem to be halted at the moment.
Having the movement cross the red line, MINUSCA had no other option but stop the progress because it would represent a direct threat of Bambari. And since November, following SPRC statement that they would march and take the war to Bambari, we warned them, we discussed with them, we had several meetings, but on Saturday we decided to launch our helicopter and it fired at the hundreds of ex-Seleka SPRC movements.
How many fatalities were there, and were they all combatants, the fatalities? Do you know?
At this stage, we cannot give you any figure with respect to casualties. What is important is that we did it and kept the pressure on the group, and particularly in between Bria and Bambari. But at the same time, we reiterate our call to the FPSC, but also to the another ex-Seleka UPC to stop the fights in that region and to dialogue in view of a peaceful solution to their grievance.
For a little background, can you explain who are the FPRC? Are they all ex-Seleka fighters?
Well, PFC and SELEC, the two main ex-SELECA groups in the Central African Republic. They are both threats because they are armed groups, and they are both committing exactions against civilian population. They are taking advantage of the wealth of the government, of the state, and they are controlling part of the country. And since November 2016, they staged a war in Bria, in the city of Bria. As I said, FPRC, which is led by Nureddin Adam, decided that it would take the war to Bambari. What we decided when FPRC made that statement was to engage with them, warning them that we have a mandate. The mandate is to protect civilian population. The fight between these two ex-SELECA groups caused around 5,000 IDPs, internally displaced people, and several victims. And we don't want this to happen in Bambari. That's why we draw some red lines. We reinforced our position. Usually we have only Mauritanian troops, but since several weeks we have also Bangladeshi forces, we have Burundian forces, we have Gabonese forces to make sure that the war is not taken to Bambari.
That was Vladimir Montero, a spokesman for the United Nations mission in the Central African Republic. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from the capital, Bangui.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 14. On this day in 1817, Frederick Douglass was believed to have been born a slave in Maryland. His real name was Frederick Bailey. At age 20, Frederick ran away to freedom. He changed his name to Frederick Douglass in order to escape capture by slave catchers. He was famous for speaking out against slavery. During the U.S. Civil War, Douglass fought for the opportunity for blacks to join the Union Army. Frederick was a friend to President Abraham Lincoln. Also on this day in 1867, Morehouse College was founded in Augusta, Georgia. The institution was later moved to Atlanta. It is a private, all-male, historically black liberal arts college. Did you know that Vanessa Williams was the first African-American to win the Miss America pageant in 1984? She went on to become a successful vocalist and actress. In July 1984, Williams again made history, this time as the first woman forced to resign her Miss America title after Penthouse magazine published explicit photos of her taken when she was 19 years old. Although Williams lost her crown and a $900,000 advertising contract, the setback only strengthened her resolve. She launched a successful singing career and has also appeared in numerous television shows and Hollywood films. Did you know that the black self-help group known as PUSH, which stands for People United to Save Humanity, was founded by the Reverend Jesse Jackson in 1971. It was later changed to People United to Serve Humanity. In 1984, following his first presidential campaign, Reverend Jackson launched the National Rainbow Coalition, which sought equal rights for all Americans. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 14th. Congratulations to Erasmus Klotze of Valleyview University in Accra, Ghana, Omiakuka Morris of the Federal Polytechnic in Oko, Anambra State, Nigeria, and Samuel Wandila of Tingola in Zambia. You are the winners of our February 13th question, which African-American author wrote the novel Roots? The answer, Alex Haley. Now, here is our question for today, February 14th. Which African-American medical doctor discovered a system to store blood plasma? Once again, which African-American medical doctor discovered a system to store blood plasma? Send your answer to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. That's it for this Tuesday, February 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, saying have a nice day.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.